You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Visa. With the capacity to process over 65,000 transaction messages every second, Visa has been bringing innovations to the way we pay for over 60 years. Imagine a world where, instead of just tapping to pay with Visa, you had to wait for everyone in front of you to cut a check. Everywhere you went. Imagine how much fun it'd be trying to track down your cousin in Milwaukee for league dues. That's why Visa's vision is to be the best way to pay and be paid everywhere so you won't have to. Whatever your goals are, Visa makes paying fast and easy. The only thing left to figure out is, where would you like to be? Visa, everywhere you want to be.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to First Things First. I'm Jen Wolf. That is Chris Candy filling in for Chris Carter right here. Nick Wright. We have football last night. We have football this weekend. We have so much to talk about this morning. The Baltimore Ravens are not worried about the Patriots' top-ranked defense, or so they say. Carson Wentz isn't scared of Khalil Mack, but the 49ers did strike some fear in Arizona last night. That's where we start this morning. Jimmy G and the Niners taking on the Cardinals. So for weeks now, the story in San Francisco has been about how good this Niners defense is. Guess who got tired of that narrative? Jimmy Garoppolo. Garoppolo put together his best game of the season, 28 for 37, 317 yards, four touchdowns. Niners get the win 28 to 25. They improve to a very perfect 8-0 on the season. Here's Jimmy G after the win.
8-0 is not going to get you anything, but it's a good start. And so we'll take the weekend to heal up, get some guys back, like you said, and make a run at this thing. I think we got a good group here. And so we got a long way to go, but we're on the right track.
Chris Candy, yesterday you sat in that seat right there, and I said, hey, listen, we're talking so much about the 49ers. We never even mentioned Jimmy Garoppolo. What gives? Well, last night, Jimmy Garoppolo heard probably everyone talking about how he perhaps didn't have a hand in the success of the Niners so far. How good are the Niners if Jimmy Garoppolo plays as well as he played last night?
Well, if he does what he did last night on a consistent basis, the 49ers are not only a team that's going to get to the postseason, but that's a team that can win some playoff games. I mean, he threw for a career-high four touchdown passes, was incredibly efficient
last
night.
Best game of the season.
Best game of the season. I mean, the 49ers offensively after those first two drives, they got it going. They reeled off three straight touchdown drives to end the half. Got an assist from Cliff Kingsbury at the end of that, calling the timeout right there at the goal line on fourth and goal. And then they ended up getting stopped, and then they get another opportunity and they punch it in. But I mean, Jimmy Garoppolo was outstanding last night. And then you saw why John Lynch traded for Emmanuel Sanders, because he was otherworldly last night in his performance. Being able to go for over 100 yards receiving on seven catches. I thought Shanahan did a great job in terms of his overall creativity and where he put Emmanuel Sanders, whether it was lining him up in stacks and bunches or putting him in the slot. He realized that Patrick Peterson was shadowing him in man coverage. And when you have a wide receiver in the slot, man-to-man, he's virtually impossible to guard because he's got a three-way go. But overall, this 49ers offense is going to be really explosive if Jimmy Garoppolo plays the way that he did, and then you get the production from Emmanuel Sanders and George Kittle.
And if people wanted to, prior to last night's game, make an excuse or at least an explanation for Jimmy Garoppolo's rather pedestrian, if not below average, stats, it would be, well, who are his weapons? Aside from George Kittle, who is an extraordinary tight end, I think most people believe one of the two best tight ends in football, he didn't have a reliable wide receiver. He appears to now have that in Emmanuel Sanders, and you saw the instant impact. He made a bigger impact yesterday than I thought he would make right out of the gate with a brand new team and a new offense, even if some of the principles are something he's used to. But to answer your question directly, Jenna, if Jimmy Garoppolo plays this well, this is the best team in football. Now, I don't know that he can continue playing this well, but if when we look at within the NFC, the three best teams, record-wise and I think eye test-wise, Niners, Packers, Saints, who has the best defense among the three? The Niners.
49ers.
Who has the best running game among the three? the 49ers. The question is, how much worse is the Niners passing game than one with Drew Brees and one with Aaron Rodgers? And up until last night, the answer was a hell of a lot worse. So much worse that people were concerned, are the Niners going to follow a script that we're very familiar with, which is the great defense, limited quarterback, very good regular season, flame out in the playoff script. That was the script of the Chicago Bears last year. One could argue that was the script of the Jacksonville Jaguars a couple years ago. It was certainly the script of the Vikings in 2015 and damn near every Cincinnati Bengal playoff team that we'd seen during the Andy Dalton, Marvin Lewis era.
But is it that the offense isn't good enough, or is it that the jury's sort of still out on this quarterback? We just don't know how, because he hasn't really been tested,
well, the
defense has really won their game.
Well, the defense and the running game. The offense, yeah. It's not that the offense, this wasn't the 2000 Ravens where you questioned all parts of their offense. Mm-hmm. This was a Niners team that could run the ball very, very well, and they had 9 touchdowns to 7 interceptions and a quarterback rating below average. Now, I don't think Jimmy G is going to be a 300-yard, 135 passer rating guy moving forward, but if he is just somewhere in the middle of where he was the first half of the year and where he was last night, that to me does elevate the Niners into the discussion right alongside, if not ahead of, the Packers and the Saints. I'm skeptical if this is duplicable against a better secondary and defense than what they have in Arizona, but if they can, then they check every single box of a championship caliber team.
Well, no, you're absolutely right, and that's what we're waiting to see, whether or not this offense can be as explosive against a better defense. I think the Arizona Cardinals defense is a low bar to clear.
Correct.
In terms of being able to judge the overall performance of what Jimmy G and his team could do. But in looking at the 49ers, you got to love the fact that they've got 5 road wins before the calendar hits November.
Sure.
So as we move into the second half of the season, you got a lot of home games. I think they've got a 3-game homestand coming up with the Seahawks, Cardinals again, and then I think
Packers. They
have the Packers. So, I mean, this is a situation where it sets up pretty good for the 49ers. They've taken care of their business up until this point. Now they're starting to be in the conversation for teams that could potentially have a first-round bye when we get to January.
Go ahead.
I was just going to piggyback off the schedule point. We are going to get the answer to this question before the playoffs begin. They have 4 of their final 8 games are against, if everyone agrees, the 4 best teams in the NFC in some order or another are Niners and then Saints, Packers, Seahawks.
Mm-hmm.
Half of their remaining games are against the Saints, Packers, Seahawks. So we will be able to find out how good they are against better defenses, against the types of teams they will face in the postseason. But up to last night, the only question mark to me, because we haven't even talked about Kyle Shanahan and what a brilliant offensive mind he continues to prove to be, the only question was, how good is their passing game going to be? And last night it was exceptional.
So as we sit here November 1st, are the San Francisco 49ers the best team in the NFC?
I'm still not ready to crown them as the best team in the NFC just because I trust what I've seen from the Saints and the Packers, but that's in part because I know what their quarterbacks are going to be.
So this is all about quarterbacks.
From a week-in, week-out basis. Now, here's the other part about this. That 49ers defense didn't bring their A game last night. Now, I know it's a short week against a division opponent, but they came out and got punched in the mouth by that Cardinals offense on the first possession, and then you saw in the second half, Cliff Kingsbury used a little bit of tempo, standardized the defensive looks, didn't allow those guys to substitute and go to those exotic blitz packages, and that 49ers defense was reeling a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not teams around the NFL, other offenses, try to employ that strategy going up against that group, because that's one of the better front sevens, if not the best front seven in all of football.
But I do find it really interesting to see the continued progression of Emmanuel Sanders and what he adds to this offense. In his whole season in Denver, which was 5 games, he had 14 catches, 180 yards. In 2 games in 5 days with San Francisco, he's got 11 catches for $140. Like, he looks...
And there's a little Kyle Shanahan in that, too.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. But it's also, no matter where you slot Jimmy Garoppolo, he's a hell of a lot better than the quarterback they had thrown to him in Denver and Joe Flacco. And for Emmanuel Sanders, for the first time since he had Peyton Manning throwing him the football, he has a legitimate NFL quarterback throwing him the football, and you're seeing him get back to, much quicker than I thought he could, the form of Emmanuel Sanders we're used to seeing.
The marquee matchup of the weekend, Ravens and Patriots. New England's defense has carried them to an 8-0 start, but they haven't faced a force yet this season, quite like MVP candidate Lamar Jackson. Pats lead the NFL in scoring defense. Ravens have the NFL's highest scoring offense. And tight end Nick Boyle proudly boasts they haven't seen anyone like our offense. Kenny, will the Ravens hand the Patriots their first loss of the season?
Well, I picked the Ravens to be able to win this game, and that's because John Harbaugh is really, really good after bye weeks. He's got a 9-2 record after bye weeks, and one of those losses came in 2015 when the Ravens set a franchise record for number of players on IR. So I expect them to have a few new wrinkles that they haven't shown on tape thus far through this point in the season. But to Nick Boyle's comments, he's absolutely right. The Pats defense hasn't seen an offense like what the Baltimore Ravens have, but that's because they haven't seen a quarterback like Lamar Jackson. He's the first quarterback in NFL history to have 1,600-plus yards passing and 500-plus yards rushing through the first seven games of the season. And so the way that the Ravens use him, not only in the run game, but what they do in terms of the passing game, being able to get him out on the perimeter and put pressure on the defense with the run-pass options that he has, that to me is what's going to be the challenge for that Patriots defense. The one thing I'll say about the Pats defense is, we know that they're on a historic pace, but the one place that they can get got is in the run game, because they're giving up 4.6 yards per attempt, which is 21st in the National Football League. So I look for the Ravens to feature a heavy dose of that run game, whether it's Lamar Jackson, Mark Ingram, Gus Edwards. This is going to be one of those fist fight in the phone booth type of games. And the Ravens, I like their chances in that type of matchup.
And the run defense is actually even worse than what you just described when you say 21st in the league over the course of the season. Since week four, so for takeaway weeks one through three, they're giving up 5.7 per carry, which is 32nd in the NFL out of 32 teams. Why has the bad run defense not hurt the Patriots in any way whatsoever? Because you're playing with such a lead so consistently, it's been so impossible to pass on this team. Teams are forced to pass. They can't pass. They turn the ball over. They give short fields. All of a sudden, you're down 17 points. Even in that Browns game, on the second of the three consecutive turnovers, that happened on a 60-yard Nick Chubb run right up the middle where he gashes the defense. I think it's caught from behind, fumbles the ball, and obviously that turns into a huge negative for Cleveland after it otherwise would have been the sign of what they could do. Throughout that football game, Nick Chubb was having success running the football. I also think the Patriots are going to lose this weekend, Jenna, and I think that we talk about football being in three phases, offense, defense, and special teams. Pats have played eight games. If you were to rank their previous eight opponents and include the Ravens, so nine available options, the very best offense of the nine that they would have faced is Baltimore. Mm-hmm. The very best special teams of the nine that they would have faced is Baltimore. And the second best defense that they would have faced is Baltimore. I think Buffalo has a better defense.
And maybe the very best quarterback Baker out of it.
No, right now there's no maybe about it. Yeah. People would say, what about Ben Roethlisberger in week one?
But he was probably already hurt.
If his elbow was, you know, 17 passes later, he's going to suffer that major injury.
Right.
Then how healthy was
he in that game
in week one? And that Steelers offense was its first game with no AB, dealing with all the transition. So no, this is, and for a while, Baltimore's, all their gaudy offensive numbers were being buttressed enormously by the 59-point explosion
Miami.
Week one.
The Miami game.
But now you've played half a season. So every extra game you play, the less impact one outlier game has. I don't look at Baltimore as the best offense in football, but they have shown that they are clearly a top 10 offense, and the Patriots have been playing nothing but bottom 10 offenses all year.
When Bill Belichick sits down to start game planning against Lamar Jackson, is there more of a focus on his arm or on his legs come Sunday?
Well, I think you have to focus on his legs, because the Baltimore Ravens want to be a run-first outfit. And when you look at what John Harbaugh and their offensive coordinator Greg Roman are trying to do, they want to change the math in the run game going up against that Patriots front seven. What I mean by that is this. In any defense, you can't account for the quarterback as a runner. So if your quarterback is going to be the ball carrier, then the tailback actually becomes an extra blocker, and that's exactly what the Ravens do. So when you have a situation where Mark Ingram is in the backfield and they're running that power O play, Lamar Jackson is the runner in that situation, and so you've got an extra blocker, so there isn't that unblocked defender that's there to make the tackle at the point of attack. So that's what makes it difficult to be able to defend. And the Baltimore Ravens, listen, they're getting healthy at the right time. Coming off of the bye week, they're expecting to have Jimmy Smith back, Patrick Owonsor, their inside linebacker, but most importantly, in my opinion, Hollywood, Hollywood Brown, who's the guy that's on the outside of that offense, out there on the edge, outside the numbers, who can stretch the field. So that's going to create a lot more room underneath for all of those other receivers, but also for Lamar Jackson, Mark Ingram in that run game.
I also want to ask you a question defensively, because I think people say when you play a running quarterback, you keep a spy on him. Man, I watched Bobby Wagner, who might be the best inside linebacker in the entire NFL. I think he's a future Hall of Famer. Be made to look slow and out of shape when they tried to have him spy Lamar. And it's not because Bobby's slow and it's not because he's out of shape, but it's because there's no linebacker in the league that can match Lamar's speed. If you can't effectively spy him with a linebacker, what do you spy him with? A safety? Do you bring an extra safety on the field? Like, what do you do to try to take his legs away when he is not just a mobile quarterback, but he is arguably the fastest quarterback we've had in the league. In fact, not arguably, the fastest quarterback we've had in the league since Michael Vick.
Well, I think we got a little bit of insight in that in the playoff game that they had against the Chargers when they had those seven defensive backs on the field and they challenged Lamar Jackson to beat him with his arm. He wasn't capable of doing that in his rookie year. I think he's capable of being able to do that now. But even beyond that, you didn't have the physicality from the running back position like you do now with Mark Ingram. And I think that has to be the difference. So when you have Lamar Jackson that's able to run the football, then you have the physical presence, that guy that can run in between the tackles and Mark Ingram, it makes it tough from a personnel groupings perspective to match up well against that Ravens offense. So listen, this is going to be a tough challenge for Bill Belichick. I don't think there are any easy answers. Typically, teams don't feature their quarterback as a running back because they don't want their quarterback being hit. But Lamar Jackson has this uncanny ability to be able to get down before he takes
hard contact. He doesn't get square shots.
He
gets his shoulder sideways. You don't see him getting lit up a lot given how often he runs. Listen, this next 6 weeks where there's five games, we're going to really find out how. We know the Patriots are really good. The numbers and the records say they're the best team in football by a wide margin. I don't believe that to be true. We're going to find out over the next five games. Baltimore, Philly, Dallas, Houston, Kansas City. You've got five legitimate playoff caliber teams that's going to be playing them with five legitimate above average, if not excellent, quarterbacks. We'll find out who the Patriots really are.
And both of you have the Ravens winning this game.
Yes.
Let's move on to the Browns now. Besides storming out of a press conference and sending out some fiery tweets, Baker Mayfield's had a relatively quiet week. Cleveland, though, trying to end their three-game losing skid, with Baker taking his league-high 12 interceptions to Mile High and must win against the lowly Broncos. Kenny, will the Browns save their season Sunday against Denver?
Well, I don't know if they're going to do it, Jenna, but we'll find out. I mean, listen, this Denver Broncos team is a feisty bunch. We saw that in Indianapolis last week. I mean, it took some heroics from Jacoby Brissett and T.Y. Hilton to set up the go-ahead game-winning field goal by Adam Vinatieri. But, I mean, listen, the fact is that the Broncos are starting a guy that's never started an NFL game. He's never played in an NFL regular season game in their quarterback, Brandon Allen. So we'll see what happens. But I don't have a lot of expectations for that offense. So if you have a shorthanded Broncos team, you should be able to take care of your business, even though you're going on the road. But I think with all of the controversy swirling around this team and their underwhelming performance coming out of the bye week, they've got to answer a lot of questions, and a win in Denver is a good way to go about doing it.
So let me say one thing about the Broncos. If NFL games, instead of being 60 minutes, were 59 minutes and 35 seconds, the Broncos would be 5-3. They've had three games where they had a lead under 30 seconds and lost on the field goal at the gun or right near the gun. That happened to him again last week. Poor Vic Fangio has waited 40 years to be a head coach to only see these types of heartbreaking losses with the first half of the season. I say that to say this. They're not a terrible football team.
No.
And we can Brandon Allen, we know nothing about him. I'm pretty confident he's not going to be way worse than Joe Flacco just because I've seen Joe Flacco the last 6 years play quarterback in this league. So with all that said, the Browns cannot save their season with a win here. But if they lose, it is a two-alarm fire turns into a three-alarm, five-alarm fire. You're bringing in units from all over the city, try to put it out, and you're not going to. The house will burn down. Baker is already clearly on the brink.
Mm-hmm.
And not the brink of his career, but the brink of this season not being salvageable. They're going to Odell Beckham for advice. And I consider Odell a friend, but I don't know that you bring him in to be the sage veteran to tell people how to calm a situation. But they got nobody else. We joke with you that you sometimes pretend you don't know what day it is. I really don't think Freddie Kitchens sometimes doesn't know what day it is.
Mm.
And if you lose to the Broncos about when you have the loss to the Patriots still stinging on Tuesday the way we know it was because Baker flipped out the way he did totally irrationally, and you have your quarterback who seems to not be ready to say, how much of this is on me? How much of this is a me problem? And where we've been talking about it, we know the Browns been saying it, even if they won't publicly say it. They know what their schedule is. They know. They in Cleveland believe, man, the first half of the season went poorly, but we're going to be fine because we got two against Cincy. We got two against Pittsburgh. We got Miami. We're going to start reeling off wins. Well, if you can't beat the Broncos, no, you're not going to start reeling off wins. So this, it's not that a win saves their season. It's that a loss officially ends it, and you're talking worst case scenario through the first eight games of the year.
It's not just that you have a guy like Baker Mayfield who happens to be extremely talented, whatever's going on this season, but you have a whole team full of skilled players who individually, we all said, are very, very talented, good football players. Somehow when they were brought together, they couldn't make it work. If it's chemistry, if it's, you know, leadership, if it's coaching, which brings us to Freddie Kitchens. Is Freddie Kitchens' job on the line now, especially what we've seen as he heads into this Denver game?
Well, Freddie Kitchens hasn't shown us anything that would lead us to believe that he's capable of being a good NFL head coach. I mean, you are what your record says you are. They're a 2-5 football team, and they're undisciplined, and I think that that falls at the feet of the head coach. I mean, they've already got 70 penalties on the season. They're on pace for 160. That would be, I think, 11 shy of the Oakland Raiders in 2011, who set the NFL record for penalties. So that speaks to the institutional control of your head coach. And then you hear the sound bites that are coming out of that locker room, Baker Mayfield and others, and players taking this us against the world mentality. That hasn't worked for them. They're not having the results that they're looking for.
But they keep going back to that.
They keep going back to that. So at some point, you have to change it. And if you're Freddie Kitchens, you have to be the one to provide that leadership to get this team back on track. I just don't know if he's capable of it. I love Freddie Kitchens. I know him. He was a position coach down with Dallas when I was there. And I was a member of that Cowboys team under Bill Parcells. But I don't know if Freddie Kitchens is capable of being a head coach in the NFL. The way he got elevated, he was the running backs coach to begin the 2018 season. Then he was interim offensive coordinator. And then because Baker Mayfield had so much success under Freddie Kitchens, because he threw 27 touchdown passes and broke the rookie touchdown pass record, they went ahead and made him the head coach because they wanted to hold on to him. But I think if you got John Dorsey in a room and actually talked to him, he would say he had reservations about doing that.
Before I answer, I just want to put you on the spot real quick. During your 11-year playing career, I assume there were a lot of guys you played for that were position coaches or coordinators went on to become a head coach, right? Mm-hmm. There's got to be some other guys. When you were with Dallas and Freddie Kitchens was there, at any point did you say, man, this guy's going to be a head coach one day?
You know what? I didn't, but that's because he was surrounded by so many guys that eventually became head coaches. Anthony Lynn, Sean Payton, Tony Sperano, Todd Bowles, all of those guys coaching staff.
But with some of those guys, did you say, oh, Anthony Lynn's going to be head coach?
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
So there's your answer.
And so that, that's a little unfair to you to do, but I think it is instructive. He's a first-year head coach. In general, I think firing coaches after their first year is too reactionary. Firing coaches within their first year has never happened. The only non-interim first-year head coach to not make it through a season, to my memory, and I believe in NFL history, is Bobby Petrino. And that's just because he dipped. He had motorcycles to ride and Louisville to coach, and he had to go.
But this wouldn't be after season. This would be a rookie coach mid-season.
No, that's what I'm saying. So he is not going to be fired within the season. But if they lose, he is coaching for his job.
Mm.
Because if they lose, this season is over and he's not back next year. The only way he gets back next year is if they claw their way to at least 8 wins, if not 9. If they lose to Denver, Then all of a sudden, 4-12, 5-11 becomes a possibility, and then he's fired, just doesn't know it yet. Like, you can put him in the same box Dan Quinn's in right now, which is like, I mean, I'm going to keep showing up to work as long as I'm allowed to, but I know I ain't going to be showing up next year.
And then they'll bring Hugh Jackson back.
No, that they
won't. That, well, they'll never do.
Nah.
Nope. When Kevin Durant and Draymond Green had an on-court altercation back in November during a Warriors loss to the Clippers, many just sort of filed it under teammates butting heads. But KD says that that argument carried more weight than most people know, and that it definitely played a role in his decision to leave the Warriors and ultimately land with the Nets. All right, Nick, this is really interesting. What do you make of all this, especially now that we know how this narrative played itself out?
Well, I'm glad Kevin Durant's being honest, finally. I mean, he says played a bigger role than most people knew. Man, there are some of us, and I understand right now, sports or otherwise, it's very in vogue to say the media's awful, the media's fake news, the media's the worst of everything. Sometimes we know things. And I'm not one that tries to defend the media, but sometimes we didn't all just get together and say, hey guys, let's start a conspiracy theory about Kevin Durant, mm-hmm. about his displeasure in mm-hmm. Golden State, about his rift with Draymond, and let's just pick a city, New York City. We were right on all of it. Mm-hmm. Now, I will admit, I had the team in New York City wrong, as a lot of people did, but we had been telling you ever since this argument that a relationship, this was a marriage that was already on the rocks, and then all of a sudden you check the phone and it's like, you've been texting with who? Okay, no, it's over. And we knew it was over. Now, I applaud KD for being honest about it. And it's tough to kill Draymond too much for two reasons. One is, Draymond always been this guy. KD knew he was this guy when he came there. And I don't know if KD comes there if Draymond is not recruiting him
right.
while he's on the Thunder.
Right.
So it's like, you know what I mean? If the person who brings you into a job is also the reason you get fired from the job, how much do you blame them if you wouldn't have gotten the job otherwise? Like, I don't know. But yes, I will give Kevin Durant credit for being more honest about this than he ever has been. Maybe now he feels he's finally able to because he's not on the team. And maybe Kevin Durant has the trauma of what happened to him on the court in the Western Conference, or in the NBA Finals, pardon me, has given him a maturity, or maybe given him, I don't want to say a peace, but mm-hmm. he's in a different place mentally than he was before. But obviously, you can't have someone call you what Draymond called him and say, we don't need you, we won without you, when that was already percolating in your brain, is that how they feel about me? And come back from that. It was the nuclear option. Draymond pressed the red button, mm-hmm. and he knew what the result would be, and Kevin Durant's now confirming it.
Yeah, I mean, fights among teammates happen. I mean, they're usually verbal. Sometimes they end up being physical altercations, yep. but there's always mutual respect there. But I think in this instance, KD feels like there was a line crossed and that Draymond Green, to a man, didn't respect him. Now, you go back to how all of this came together. I think this was a marriage born out of necessity because the Golden State Warriors, Draymond Green, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, they wanted to keep this dynastic run pushing. And then KD, obviously, he knew that he needed some jewelry for his resume and ultimately his legacy. So when they came together some years back, it was something that was mutually beneficial. But I think that as it's run its course, as they won championships, and as KD got a finals MVP, he recognized that he was never going to get the credit that he was seeking in Golden State because the core of that team was already in place before he got there, and they had already won at the highest level. So I think he recognized that at some point he's going to have to branch off and start his own team where he is the focal point and the unquestioned leader in order to check the boxes that he wants to check and be in that conversation for all-time greats. I think he's already an all-time great. But when you look at these players nowadays, when you look at LeBron James and all of these guys, they're consumed with how they'll be remembered. And I think that that was the motivation for KD alongside with the rift with Draymond Green to leave this past summer.
You wonder if Draymond regrets any of it, just judging from where the Warriors are right now. But if you were the Warriors and your sole purpose moving into a new arena was to try to keep this core intact, or what I mean is try to keep KD there, what would you have done differently? If
they could have traded Draymond last year after this happened. And I know there were at least
would that
very,
have made it KD
No, but
stay?
That's the problem. The problem is KD was already, it's now been reported, KD, Kyrie, and DeAndre Jordan on a luxury ship in, you know, during the 2016 Rio Olympics, all got together and said, it'd be really fun if we could play together one day. Mm-hmm. Not shockingly, a few weeks later, Kyrie, who a few weeks prior had talked about being so excited about extending his run with LeBron, he not only demands a trade, but says, I'll have knee surgery if you don't trade me. He is working his way out. Kevin Durant that summer decides to go with the Golden State Warriors, and then they all had their eyes on playing together in New York, one of the teams in New York, at some point in the future. Kevin Durant, I'm not the first person to say this, so it's not my take, but I think it's the correct take. He's a seeker. He's looking for what's next and looking for a level of fulfillment that he thought the championship would bring him. It did not. When you say it was out of necessity, now that is totally correct, because what the Warriors had realized was, man, this dude, LeBron James, he took a 6 when his second best teammate was Della Vadova, came back from 3-1 down on the best team we've ever had on a 73-win team. We need some help. And Kevin Durant's thinking, the team that just came back from 3-1 down on me lost to the guy who beat me in the finals, the first time I was in the finals. So they needed to come together to overcome what LeBron and Kyrie were doing out east. But it was always a shotgun marriage. And it was always, and people are going to kill Draymond. I know, Candy, the narrative is going to be, how many championships Draymond cost him? Because people think they wouldn't have lost in 2016 if Draymond doesn't punch at LeBron and get suspended. I think they would have anyway, but regardless. Mm-hmm. And now you lose Kevin Durant and the team's a mess. Okay, but Draymond got Draymond is the one that was recruiting Kevin Durant during the season. Draymond is the one that was tears in his eyes in the parking lot after they had lost to the Cavs, said, KD, we need you. If Draymond hadn't been all in on that, KD doesn't go there to begin with. So how much did he cost you? How much did he help you win? Those to me are part and parcel with the same conversation.
And here's the thing. It was a point of contention because from Draymond Green and the rest of those Golden State Warriors, they couldn't understand why Kevin Durant would leave a perfect basketball situation to go somewhere else. I mean, it's already a historically great team. Why would you leave that? The only reason that you would be for individual recognition. Yes. It wouldn't be for team goals. And I think that was the frustration from Draymond Green, who's the ultimate team player.
KD wants to be one of the greatest players ever. Right now, he's considered the third best player of his own era. LeBron, Steph, Durant. That's tough.
Yep. Back here, First Things First, we are now joined by former All-Pro running back Brian Westbrook. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, good morning.
Great to see you. Brian, we're talking about...
Come on now, get right now.
Come on, man.
Come on now.
What just happened?
He has the biggest hands I've ever...
Little misstep right there. It's all right. We got a bunch of segments with you guys.
He went aggressive. He went a little bit too aggressive.
I'm so glad.
He's here for 5 segments. We have 5 more chances for you to get that right.
That's on Kenny, man. The guy with the...
You see how it feels to have an awkward open?
The bigger guy, it's on him to make sure the connection's not missed.
Sense.
Everybody knows the rules of DAP, Candy.
Except I don't know the rules of DAP. Brian, big weekend for the Philadelphia Eagles, a team that seems lost so far this season. Carson Wentz still searching for an identity for his 4-4 team, and the search won't get any easier against Khalil Mack and the Chicago Bears and that defense. But Wentz said the Eagles offense isn't, quote, afraid of former Defensive Player of the Year Khalil Mack. So, Brian, who's got the edge in this matchup?
You know, when I think about the game, I have to start on the defensive side of the ball for the Eagles. And, you know, they've gotten much more healthy. Fletcher Cox is getting healthy. Brandon Graham continues to play well. But more importantly, in the secondary, they got two of the starters back, Ronald Darby and Jalen Mills. And getting those two guys back is going to help this defense tremendously. And, again, you're facing Mitchell Trubisky, 5 touchdowns on the season. They have problems scoring the football in Chicago. And so when I look at the Eagles' defense, I give them the edge. But then you have to flip it over to the offensive side of the ball for the Eagles. And the big question, how do you slow down Khalil Mack? And there's a couple of different ways, and I would certainly want to run it by you. To slow down edge rushers, you run away from them, you double team them, or how about you just run the football? And that's something that the Eagles did a bunch last week, 41 times against the Buffalo Bills, and they were very successful with it with Miles Sanders. They were very successful with Jordan Howard. And so I think they should just try to do that. When you face a Bears defense that's going to get after the quarterback, run the football. The other thing you have to think about this Bears defense is simple. 2 of the last 3 games, they've given up over 150 yards rushing. They've given up over 150 yards rushing, which to me sounds kind of crazy when you're talking about one of the better defenses in the league. That's something that the Philadelphia Eagles can take advantage of. I think that's where they face, and that's where they start at offensively.
Well, the Eagles had a lot of success up in Buffalo running the football against a pretty good Buffalo front seven. So if they can continue to do that, I think that has to be their identity if they're going to have success on the offensive side of the ball and as a team. Play keep away from the opposing offense and then being able to move the ball methodically down the field. But if you're going to do that, you can't have a lot of negative plays. And that's the one thing that concerns me about this Philadelphia Eagles team. Don't turn the football over. No negatives in terms of tackles for losses or sacks on your quarterback. That's the area that they've got to make sure that they take care of going up against the Chicago Bears team, because the only real path to victory for the Bears is if their defense is able to steal extra possessions and create short fields for Mitch Trubisky. You learned all you needed to know about how the Bears feel about their quarterback last week against the Chargers when they get the ball on the 21-yard line with 43 seconds left.
And a timeout.
And Matt Nagy runs the clock out and elects to kick that long field goal as opposed to trying to gain more yards and put Eddie Pinheiro in a better situation. I think he did that because he doesn't trust his quarterback. That's not going to change in a week. So correct. I think that's the biggest thing for the Eagles. Take care of the football, no negative plays, and you starve that Chicago Bears offense.
I love Matt Nagy as a play caller. I played against him in college, but not only did you not trust your quarterback, you didn't trust your running back that had a really good game last week. Hand the ball off to Montgomery, allow him to get 5, 6, 7 yards, make it
God forbid a touchdown.
And
you don't have to kick the field goal.
You don't have to kick the field goal. That was just a bad coaching job last week.
Our friend from Lock It In, Cousin Sal, and in honor of tonight being Friday Night SmackDown, I'll use one of his lines, which is a wrestling line. This Bears-Eagles match is the old loser leaves town match, where it is the loser of this football game, you can just go ahead and cross them off. All year long with Philly, we've been like, well, can you cross them off given the division? If they can't take the game plan that was so successful against Buffalo and beat a Bears team that is ripping itself apart at the seams because there is so much talent, I actually still think Matt Nagy, even at the game management stuff, drove me crazy this weekend, does design an interesting offense, one of those Andy Reid folks, disciples, that the fissure on that team is about the quarterback play and about how everything has to be done, keeping in mind, well, what can we trust our quarterback to do? I've got friends that do radio and media in Chicago. All week long, it has been, who are the best quarterbacks coming out of college? Should they go to Chase Daniel? This, if you lose to that Bears team coming off that type of loss where they're in last place in the NFC North, then guess what, Philly? You're not good. Like, we can say all this talent, all these expectations, only a half game. If you can't beat this Bears team this week, then you're just a bad football team. And what helps Philadelphia so much is exactly what you said. Playing Buffalo and Chicago in back-to-back weeks is just a gift from the scheduling gods because they're built so similarly. They have so many similarities on the defensive side and on the offensive side, and you were just so successful against Buffalo. Now, I know Chicago's going to expect you to go do the same thing, but at least Philly has a second punch where, okay, you're going to sell out against stopping the run? No problem. We still have a Pro Bowl caliber quarterback back there that if we need to, we can go to the passing game. But that is, to me, if Philly loses this game, it's a wrap for them, which is one of the reasons why I don't think they will lose this
game. Chicago's the same team coming in. The Eagles get DeSean Jackson back. At least we assume they do. And that has to open up the game a little bit. How do you see that factoring into what the Eagles are going to be able to do?
Well, I think it certainly does open up the game. They haven't had DeSean Jackson healthy since week one. And so that's going to open up the field for everyone, Zach Ertz included, who hasn't had a very much impact all season.
Because there's been no real deep threat.
Absolutely. So they haven't had that. And so I think it opens up things. But here's the thing. In order to get the ball deep, you got to have a 5 to 7 step drop. And that's the danger territory against this defense, because those guys, they're running to that spot, that 5-step drop spot. That's where they're getting to on their pass rushes. So, again, I go right back to the run game. Because Chicago's not going to put up a lot of points offensively, you know that you can be much more patient with your run game if you're the Philadelphia Eagles. I would stick with that, and I wouldn't worry as much about getting the ball deep. I wouldn't worry about as much trying to get DeSean Jackson involved in the offenses early. We're going to run the football until they stop it, and once they dedicate 8, 9 guys to stop the run, then we'll take some shots down the football field and see where we go from there.
No, you're absolutely right. The game plan for the Eagles on offense has to start with developing a plan for Khalil Mack. But overall, I think this Eagles team has to start fast. This is the first game of a three-game homestand. It's an opportunity for them to gain some ground. They're already behind. They lost a head-to-head to the Dallas Cowboys. So they've got to build some momentum for their season. And if you're facing a team that's struggling in the Chicago Bears, if you start fast and get on them early, you continue to have that doubt with that Bears sideline. So I think this is a situation where if the Eagles handle their business in the first half, they can put this game away early.
And you mentioned the three-game homestand, but the next two are New England and Seattle. Yeah. So if you can't beat the Bears at home, the hell chance you have against those two teams. Right.
Brian, how good could the 49ers be if Jimmy Garoppolo plays the way he played last night?
Jimmy G played well last night. I mean, he looked good. He stood in the pocket, delivered a football down the field. He was on time with his passes. He was able to get outside the pocket, throw accurately down the football field. In the face of pressure was probably the most impressive part for me. 14 to 20, 152 yards with eight guys loading the box, trying to blitz him, two touchdowns as well. He just looked good. He keeps that offense moving. And when you have an offense that has the ability to run the football, they're going to stack the box. They're going to try to stop the run, take that away, and make him win the football game. And if he could throw like he did yesterday, and you add George Kittle, healthy George Kittle, you add Emmanuel Sanders, healthy Emmanuel Sanders that can stretch the field and catch a slant and go 80 yards for a touchdown, that offense is just hard to beat. And of course, you know what the defense can do. I think the last night, they looked vulnerable defensively, took a night off. Offensively, they stepped up and they played very well. This 49ers team is just going to be hard to beat, especially if you have to go out there and play.
Yeah, well, they were looking for a number one receiver, and general manager John Lynch made a move at the deadline to bring over Emmanuel Sanders, and that's giving you early returns, and you see the performances that he's had in his first two games with the club. So really impressed by what this offense has shown, especially what they did last night. Sanders having a big night, over 100 yards and a touchdown. George Kittle, kind of figured he would have a big game because the Cardinals defense is the worst at defending tight ends in the National Football League. But I just think that you saw a performance last night from the trigger man, Jimmy Garoppolo, that has to make you feel good. And if you're a Niners fan or a player in that locker room, you're confident about what this team is capable of accomplishing. Because as we move into the second half, there is going to be a step up in class in terms of the competition that you're going to be facing. But if your quarterback plays like that, I mean, Jimmy G was lights out last night, but especially in situational football. On third downs, he was 12 of 14 passing, three touchdowns, no picks, and 159 yards. If your quarterback can execute in the critical phases of the game, when the pressure is at its highest, you have to feel good about that when you get to those closely contested games late in the season, December, going on into the playoffs.
So you mentioned something that's a kind of a hidden stat there. You said on fourth downs, he was 12 of 14 passing.
Third downs.
Yeah, that would be a hot number of fourth down attempts to go for in a game. Yeah. But they had 17 third down attempts. They converted 11 of them. The reason I bring that up is the only way you're getting that many third down attempts is A, if you're consistently moving the sticks, and B, if you're consistently in third and very manageable. Mm-hmm. People say third down's the most important down in football. Well, yeah, because it's the do or die down typically, but you want to avoid it. Like, the smarter football minds are continuing to realize the goal is not to get in third and manageable, it's to avoid it altogether. But the Niners were in third and short so often, they were able to consistently convert. To your question, Jenna, about how good are they if Jimmy G plays this way, well, if he plays anything close to this, they check every single box. We all believe in Kyle Shanahan as a coach.
Yep.
I do.
Yep.
We all agree they have an elite defense, even if they didn't show it last night. They have an elite running game, even if they didn't have to lean on it last night. The question has been, the pass catchers other than Kittle, Emmanuel Sanders now is starting to answer that question, and the quarterback play. The only asterisk we'll put on it is the Arizona Cardinals this year are 29th in the NFL in points allowed, 29th in the NFL in yards allowed, 29th in the NFL in passing defense. So you are playing across the board a bottom four defense, and that led to some of the success. But we're going to get to find out with this team. They got eight games left. Four of them are against Seattle, New Orleans, and Green Bay. The other three teams that are right there in the top four in the conference, the two teams they'll be competing with for a bye, and Seattle, the team they'll be competing with for the division. So we will get to find out, but this was a great moment for Jimmy Garoppolo. And if you're a Niner fan, it's the first time all year you feel like, oh, we might be a complete team, which was the question.
But maybe Kyle Shanahan knew where the weakness on offense was and said, well, defense ranked 29th in the passing. Like, this is where we could make exploit. Jimmy Garoppolo feel confident. This is where Jimmy Garoppolo can go out there and say, well, it's not just the defense that's winning games for us. I have a hand in this as well, which is what you're going to need if you're going to start making a playoff push. How much does a game like this help your quarterback, regardless of who the opposition is?
Well, I think you should have a lot of confidence. If you're Jimmy G, you're behind an offensive line that does a pretty good job protecting you, but you have a run game. So now defenses are saying, we're going to put 7-8 guys in the box, and now you're throwing against man-to-man on the outside. You have one of the faster receivers in the league, Emmanuel Sanders. And when you look at George Kittle, he's one of the fastest tight ends and the most physical tight ends in the NFL right now, if not the fastest or most physical tight end. He's a guy that can get open in any situation. And so in these situations, this makes it easy for your quarterback. These are easy. Those are 7-on-7 throws right there. You're talking about a guy that's wide open, no pressure in your face. These are easy throws for any quarterback in the NFL. He did a great job yesterday of it, but a lot of that has to do with the run game. That run game sets a tone for this team. You know, when you have that, it makes it easier in quarterback.
And you mentioned the offensive line. The offensive line is still not whole yet. You're going to get Joe Staley back from the broken fibula and then Mike McGlinchey at some point. So the run game and the pass protection, that's only going to continue to improve as they get healthier.
And they're going to get Kyle Juszczyk back at some point, who might be the best fullback in football. That'll also help as far as their running game and, you could argue, their pass protection if he's in there on a passing down.
And when they get Jerry Rice back, it's going to be really great. You're going to be so great.
Roger Craig and Ronnie Lott, too.
Brian Westbrook, will the Browns save their season on Sunday? You know, could they also lose their season on Sunday?
They certainly could. I mean, this is their last chance. I think that, you know, you're playing against a football team in the Broncos that's getting a brand new quarterback in Brandon Allen, so you have a little bit of an advantage there. But it's really for the Browns. It's always been about the Browns. It's about how do you manage your expectations, how do you get ready for a football game, and can you get better week to week? And in the NFL, if you don't get better from week to week, then you're just going to be an average football team at the end of the day, and the Browns are below average. And so when you look at this team, first thing, discipline. Are they a disciplined football team? Absolutely not. They have 24 pre-snap penalties. That's just hard to do. That's fifth most in the NFL, 24 pre-snap penalties. First game of the season, 18 penalties. Last week against the Patriots, 13 penalties. So they're continuing to do the same thing over and over and over again, and they're not getting better. All three of those things, that's what get head coaches fired. Mm-hmm. So they have to find a better way to do it. Again, they have the ability to run the football. Don't put as much pressure on your quarterback. That's what I would be aiming to do. But at some point, you're going to have to throw the football down the field. That means Baker Mayfield is going to have to throw the ball to the guys in his jersey, not the opposing jersey. He leads the league in interceptions, not doing a very good job of taking care of the ball.
Yeah, the pre-snap penalties and the turnovers, those are all focus issues. And that's something, as a head coach, either you're coaching it that way or you're allowing it to happen. Either way, the results are it's going to be hard to win football games when you're doing that. I mean, if you're going to try to win games, you have to first do the things to avoid losing football games. And the Browns just have not been able to get out of their own way. And so looking at this matchup, I mean, the Cleveland Browns better be careful here. Like, it's easy to get up after a bye week knowing that you're going to play an undefeated Patriots team in Foxborough. But to have the attention to detail and the focus during the preparation to go play a 2-6 Denver Broncos team, it might not be as crispy, might not be as sharp. And this Denver Broncos team has had a lot of clubs on the ropes. It's just things late in games don't typically go their way. But the Denver Broncos are a sack safety by Von Miller away from getting a win in Indy. And I think we would all agree the Indianapolis Colts are a pretty good football team.
Or just a missed Adam Vinatieri field goal.
That's right.
Exactly. Vinatieri's got to kick a field goal at the gun from 50-plus, or the Broncos win that game.
Exactly. So, I mean, the Cleveland Browns have to be careful with this one because, Nick, you said this earlier, they can't save their season with this win, but if they lose this game on Sunday, their season is over.
Right. That's exactly correct. There is no way to save it this week, but it can die this week. Because we need to talk about what they've done the last month. Because week four, they beat Baltimore. And it's like, okay, Baltimore had just lost to Kansas City. They lose to Cleveland. And it's like, oh, all right. So we're tied for first in the division. In fact, they were in first in the division because of the tiebreaker. What have they done since then? They go to San Francisco on national television and get annihilated, embarrassed in that football game. They play Seattle and blow a 2-score lead. And then when they have a chance to come back and salvage the game, Baker throws a pick on that final drive. They then have a week to prepare, because they have a bye week for New England. How does that game start? Here's the first four drives. Three and out, turnover, turnover, turnover. You mentioned earlier when we were talking about Baltimore, John Harbaugh's record after the bye. Mm-hmm. Andy Reid famously has an outstanding record after the bye. Bill Belichick's got a great record under all circumstances, but particularly after the bye. The best coaches have their teams extra prepared. Sean McVay, when he has extra time, whether it be a Thursday night game, beginning of a season, after a bye, going into this year, the only game he had lost in those circumstances were against Bill Belichick actually going. The best coaches in football get you ready to go. The Browns played, I thought, actually pretty well in that football game, except for the first quarter where they lost the football game. So now you play Denver, a team who is right now got to feel as sick about where they are as anybody in football, because they're 2-6, but they are three field goals in the final 30 seconds of games away from being 5-3, away from being tied with the Chiefs for first place in the AFC West. If you can't beat that team with Brandon Allen taking his first career snaps, if you can't at least salvage this portion of the season a little bit, then, yeah, Freddie Kitchens is like, is he coaching for his job? He is. Not because they'll fire him nine games,
at the end of the season, or do you think he's coaching for his job after this game?
Well, so I do not think John Dorsey is going to fire a first-year head coach inside of his first year. I do think if they lose this game, their season is over. And if this season is an abject disaster, Freddie Kitchens can sign his head coach death certificate, if you will, with a loss this weekend. Now, it won't actually be delivered until the first week of January, but if they lose this game, I would wager any amount of money he is not the head coach week one of the 2020 season.
A big part of an offensive coach's job is to make sure that your quarterback, your young quarterback, progresses and gets better year after year. Baker Mayfield has not gotten better. Actually, he's gotten worse. And so this football team and Freddie Kitchens' job in particular certainly is in big concern, because their quarterback and their play has not gotten better. But the talent around them has. And that's more of a bigger problem, because the expectations were high. And right now what they've been delivering has been very, very low.
Listen, remember at the beginning, you know, in the offseason when they were looking for a head coach after what happened last year, one of the names that was brought up was Mike McCarthy's name, who's been in the league many years, who understands what discipline is, who's not going to allow pre-snap penalties and turnovers and sloppy play and all of it. But they instead went with someone who Baker felt very comfortable with, who probably Baker put great words into John Dorsey for. And you see that it's not really working out. Would the other way have been better? Is it that the team needed more discipline, or are the players equally to blame as Freddie Kitchens?
Well, I listened to all the comments from Baker Mayfield, and maybe he needs a coach, either an offensive coordinator or a quarterback coach, that's going to be disciplined with him.
And not
that's
going
to hold him accountable. That's going to say, listen, this is not okay. Don't pitch the ball to the other team. If you see the color, hold on to the football. If your guy is double teamed, throw it to the guys in your jersey, or just throw it away. Maybe they need to find a guy that's going to be more disciplined. And if you look at this roster, up and down on the offensive and defensive side of the ball, they have a bunch of talent, but discipline has been the issue throughout the entire the Freddie Kitchens era in Cleveland. That's going to be a problem for him as far as the head coaching job.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. Just because you're a good position coach or a good coordinator doesn't mean you're going to be a good head coach, because it's not like you're just responsible for Baker Mayfield and his development, but you're responsible for developing a culture on an entire football team. And that's the one question mark that we haven't gotten an answer from Freddie Kitchens so far. And if we continue to have that be a question mark, eventually the answer is going to be no. He's not capable of setting the agenda for this team. He's not capable of providing leadership for a young locker room. And so that was one of the concerns coming into this season, how this team would handle adversity and who they would turn to when things got bumpy. Because BW noticed, in an NFL season, you're going to go through some things as a team. It's not going to all go according to plan. And it's how you respond that's going to determine whether or not you have a successful season. So far, the Cleveland Browns have failed at responding in the right way. And if they don't respond this weekend in Mile High Stadium, this season will be considered a failure.
Mike McCarthy is not the guy they should have hired, even if he would have been better than Freddie Kitchens. Bruce Arians is the guy they should have hired. Now, I don't know. It seems like Bruce really wanted to coach Tampa. For some reason or another, it seemed like that's what he was targeting.
Maybe weather's a lot better in Tampa.
Weather's a lot better. And maybe he believed in Jameis to a way that I don't necessarily believe in Jameis, or whatever it was. There wasn't a lot of talk about Cleveland hiring Bruce Arians. I'm just simply saying he's an offensive mind who also brings a level of accountability. Right now, I'm very confident saying of the eight coaches who were hired this offseason, some are unknowns. There are two where the team hired the wrong guy. Adam Gase with the New York Jets and Freddie Kitchens with the Cleveland Browns. Now, Zach Taylor's 0-8, but I don't know if he's the wrong guy or not. That team might just be so bereft of talent and you're retooling it. The Browns made the wrong decision. Now, if they turn it around, he will get a year two. But at some point, before Baker gets his second contract in this league, he's going to be on his third head coach in this league. And that's not even counting the interim head coach in Greg Williams. And I feel like we know that seven games in.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. And catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.